Welcome to Innovation Alberta. I'm Cheryl Crocher. On this evening's program, a look at hybrid poplars. Alan Robertson looks after the Farm Poplar Program for Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, and his group has been experimenting with poplars from all around the world to find out which ones will adapt to the northern Alberta climate. Tim Guylander oversees the hybrid poplar program at Weyerhaeuser. He takes us into the greenhouse laboratory, where poplar pollen is collected for crossbreeding experiments. And Dan McPherson of the Woodlot Association of Alberta talks about poplar farming as an alternative to cereal crops. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. For several decades, farmers have been planting hybrid poplars as shelter belts as part of the Prairie Farm Rehabilitation Program. Now, forest companies are looking to farmers to grow poplars for them. These poplar crops would supply fiber for the mills while taking some pressure off our natural forests. Of course, no one wants to wait 70 or 80 years for that crop to mature, so the push is on to develop hybrid poplars that will be ready for harvest in 15 or 20 years. Alan Robertson is the Poplar Farm Coordinator for Alberta Pacific. The company's mill near Athabasca uses poplar to make pulp for global markets. I walked with Alan through the neat rows of poplars that ALPAC planted on a test site in 1993. He is evaluating hybrid poplars from around the world, as well as from Alberta locations like Collington, Slave Lake, and Fort McMurray.
The neat thing about having all these balsam poplars from 20 different sites on one site is you can see the differences in genetics versus where they came from in the environment. And there are some definite trees that we would say are doing far better here, and they may be used down the road in a traditional breeding program and crossed with other trees.
What would be some of the ones that are doing better?
There's one variety from Slave Lake area that has grown far better than any others, and that will probably be used in the future for a breeding program. And there are differences from every area, and they have been ranked by height and diameter, and that will be monitored over the next 10 to 15 years.
Now, you see quite a bit of difference between the characteristics of the different plots of trees. What are these nice, tall, straight ones over here?
This is a block of Manitou and Walker hybrid poplars. They're shelter belt trees developed by the Prairie Farm Rehabilitation Administration, and they were developed in the last 20 to 30 years and have been used as shelter belt trees throughout the prairie provinces. We have been involved quite extensively with the PFRA and have used some of their material for our initial starting point. They did the original work in hybrid poplars for the prairies and have the expertise and the material that has allowed us to move ahead in our program at a quicker rate.
Now, over here, you've got other trees, looks like from the signs, they're Washington, Germany, Japan, Europe, Illinois. What are you finding with tree species from these different areas?
What we're looking for here is what trees are going to provide the best growth, yield, and survival capability for this area. Many of the trees that we're trying in this trial have not survived well, and that is due to the location they were selected from. Trees like Trichocarpa from the Washington area, some of the black poplar species from Europe, Nigra, do not survive the winter here well all the time, and they have been weeded out of the process just because of that. And you can see they're shorter, they're stubbier, they look like there's parts of them have died back, and that happens every year to them because of the winters here. Other trees, like the deltoides and the balsamifera from Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, Quebec, have proven that they can grow well here and grow at as good a rate and better rates than any of the native trees.
So the main thing then is cold hardiness, is that it?
That is one of the first things we look at as far as weeding them out of a program. We also look at overall height, diameter, and we look at some of the fiber characteristics. Some of the fiber characteristics that are important to the mill is the wood density, and the higher the wood density, the better the yield through the mill. Right now we're targeting trees that are going to give us at least an average wood density to what the mill is using now, and we're, through our breeding program, we're trying to get a higher wood density. We want to get fiber length and fiber characteristics that are at the same level that the mill is using now, so we don't disrupt the process.
Now, I notice you've got aspen and you've got balsam poplar. Is there one that's better than the other?
Most of the poplar programs have used the balsam poplar, which is more closely associated with the cottonwood species, for their programs. It is easier to breed in a traditional breeding program and easier to use in an operational situation because of its rooting characteristics. It roots easier from dormant cuttings than aspen does.
Is there anything special that you have to do in order to make them grow on a farm or in a farming type situations that would be different from the way they grow out in the woods?
We like to refer to what we're doing as farming rather than forestry because the operational in the operational situation, what we do is more closely related to traditional agriculture than it is forestry. We look at fertilization, mechanical and chemical weed control. We look at trying to maximize the output in a given area of land in the shortest period of time. And it's intensive management, and it follows the same guidelines and same practices as agriculture.
From a cost point of view, would that make these very expensive trees?
The upfront costs are a little higher than in traditional forestry because you're giving more inputs into the land, but it helps reduce your rotation to 15 to 20 years, and you get more returns and a higher volume of wood from a smaller area.
You're doing this now in a trial situation on a small area of land, but if it goes the full 9 yards and you end up in a situation where you have farmers all around northern Alberta farming poplars, what's the benefit economically to them?
The benefit to the farmers is that it helps diversify their income on the land. It allows them to have some more stability in agriculture, and it provides an income down the road so that there is some gains from their activities on the land.
One of the concerns that some people have raised is that if you're growing hybrid species on farms, that there is the potential for them to perhaps interfere with the natural poplar and aspen boreal forest out there. Is that really a concern?
We don't have a concern with that right now. The shelter belts, which contain hybrid poplars, have been growing across the prairies, right beside natural populations of natural forests for the past 40 years and longer, and we have not seen an ingress into the natural forest. So we're looking at this as a low risk to the native forest. We're also following up on this theory with a research study involving the university, the Forest Service, and other industry, where we're looking at both the molecular side and the physical trees of shelter belts and forest side by side to ensure that there has been no ingress in the past.
When you look at certainly the costs or the benefits from the company's point of view, but from an environmental perspective, what could be considered some of the environmental impacts or benefits of going into the sort of agroforestry approach?
The intensive management of poplars allows Alberta Pacific to manage the natural forest a lot better as well. Alberta Pacific operates on a triad approach where we're looking at extensive management, conservation, and intensive management. By having the intensive management side of it, it allows us to manage better within the natural forest, leave more area for both wildlife concerns, environmental concerns, and actually allows us to harvest our trees in a more ecologically friendly manner.
So essentially it would take the pressure off the wild forest?
Yes, it does. It keeps some of our fiber coming from an intensive operation, and we don't have to take that from the natural forest.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Alan Robertson, coordinator of the Poplar Farming Program at Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. Coming up, a look at Weyerhaeuser's experiments in crossbreeding poplars. Just north of Drayton Valley, Weyerhaeuser has set up a greenhouse and orchard for its experiments in hybridizing poplar. Like Alpac, this forest company is also interested in promoting poplar as a farm crop. Tim Highlander is the company forester in charge of the Aspen Tree Improvement Program, supported by Weyerhaeuser and a coalition of other aspen users in the province. I joined him in the greenhouse lab, where poplar pollen samples are stored and collected.
Pollen is going to be used for controlled crosses with aspen trees, native aspen trees that we've selected as part of our breeding program to produce improved material for deployment on plantations and woodlots.
How important would this program be to your company?
We, as a company, consume a lot of deciduous fiber in our Slave Lake OSB mill, our Edson OSB mill, and our Drayton Valley OSB mill. And part of that fiber supply is being sourced off private land. And that portion of fiber isn't being renewed or sustained. So this breeding program is sort of a hedge or an insurance policy to just make sure that we've got some material to put back that's maybe a little bit better and grows faster. So at this point, we haven't really quantified the exact benefit, but it's sort of a hedge on the future.
What else do you have? I see you've got some things in the freezer. Can we look in there?
Sure. So in past years, we've collected pollen for use in breeding, and we try and use the pollen in the same season that it's collected because its viability is higher, but can't always be done. So we've stored some, and we try and store it in vacuum. I'll pick one up. Vacuum-sealed ampules, and we store them at minus 20, and we've had pretty good success with the viability being maintained over several years. The other series of vials are either open-pollinated natural seed collected off wild trees that we're using in some of our silviculture experiments, and the other set of smaller vials are seeds that we've collected off of controlled pollinations from previous seasons.
Well, just looking at all of these little vials in here, it almost looks like you've got vials of salt and pepper. That's what it looks like. They're all labeled differently. What are some of the things you can tell me about some of the individual ones?
Just to address your salt and pepper comment, the seed is so fine that it's hard to extract the seed and get the sort of the chaff and capsules extracted from the seed. So that's why, some of it looks dirty. And some of it looks cleaner. Your comment about labels, because everything is a controlled cross, we want to maintain a unique identity of the seed so we can follow it right through the tests and the results of the tests. So each tree is labeled with a unique identifier, which identifies the female and the male parent, and then the cross number for that year and the year that it was done.
Now, I notice out in the greenhouse here you have everything covered up. Why is that?
Basically, it's pollen, male pollen extraction, and we don't want to have cross-contamination, so we've got everything isolated in different cages.
How is it that you collect the pollen?
What we're doing is we've got branches collected off male trees, and we put them in buckets of water, put them into the greenhouse, and the days, number of days that it takes to flush it out decrease as spring approaches, but currently in the first part of March here, it would be about 10 days to get a male to flush out its reproductive buds. And once that's happened, all the pollen is sort of born on the reproductive structure, and we just take a pair of scissors, snip off the structure, collect it in a a white tray, and we generally hold it in that tray for a few hours just to try and reduce the moisture content a little bit, at which time we would take the contents of that tray, run it through some fine meshed sieves to actually extract the pure pollen and place it in a vial.
And then after you place it in the vial, what happens?
It basically, we just hold it in this +2 degree fridge until it's sort of its cue comes up in the breeding cycle, at which time we would take the individual that we've identified to cross with a specific female, take it out. We use a pollen sort of atomizer, we put it into the atomizer, and we would spray that pollen onto the receptive female and then just wait for fertilization to take place and then collect seed later.
The different samples that you've got out there, why have you chosen those ones?
We try and target good-looking representative trees that are free of insect disease and have good form. And there was actually a few individuals within the greenhouse that we obtained from a cooperative program in eastern Canada. And we thought, one, since the material was available, that we would try crossing it with our native material in an experiment just to see if it, one, if it would work, and two, if that material was adapted to Alberta conditions.
What are the results on that?
No results yet. We've got some preliminary indication that there might be adaptability and that it might work, and we still have to actually obtain the seed and design an experiment and plant it out.
But for the most part, are they trees from right around this area or from across the province?
The female trees that the pollen will be placed on or bred with are from across the province. A few individuals from Saskatchewan form our population, and a few from northern BC as well.
What are we standing in front of now?
Well, again, we're in the lab. And because aspen has a unique ability to both reproduce sexually with the pollen and the seed, as we spoke about earlier over at the freezer, it also has the ability to clonally reproduce via root suckers. So we also wanted to be able to screen our material clonally. And this bench is a light bench, which we take cuttings, which are root sprouts, off of aspen roots that we collect in the spring, place them in these small jiffy plugs under domes to keep the humidity up, turn the lights on so they've got lots of photosynthetic power, and we grow them out, try and get minimum of 20, but hopefully 100 clones or replicates of one tree, and if we get enough of those, we'll put them into a clonal screening trial to rank the different individuals.
How long does that take?
We do the whole process is sort of like on a 1-year cycle. So when the frost comes out of the ground in the spring, we'll send out crews which will excavate the root. This year we've got a protocol of collecting about 4 meters of root off one tree. The good thing is that the aspen roots are always very, very close to the surface, so there's not a lot of excavating that's required, so it goes quickly. So Weyerhaeuser will collect 20 roots this spring. Through our co-op, we're hoping to get another 80 roots for a total of 100 roots. And once the roots are brought into the greenhouse, put in beds of vermiculite, within 2 weeks we should get sprouts, and at that time we'll start cutting the sprouts off, sticking them or transplanting them into these mini plugs on this light bench that we're standing in front of. And it takes about another 10 days for those, we call them stecklings, to root in this new media and form what we call a steckling. Basically a cutting derived into a seedling form.
Would it then go into the greenhouse?
Yeah, we have a transition period because the light intensity, even though they're directly under these lights, the light intensity is low compared to what natural sunlight provides. So we bring them into the greenhouse for a second conditioning step, and at that point they can either be moved outside or into another holding area, and they're quite stable at that point.
When would they ever get put into the ground?
Well, we grow them for the summer season so that they've got good height and caliper, so they're a nice vigorous plant. Then we package them up into an experimental design, into replicates. We shut them down, cold storage, and then the following year in the spring, we take the dormant plants out of storage and plant them into an experiment. So last year, so spring of 2000, we ran 70 clones through this process. Those trees are currently in cold storage, and spring 2001, we will plant those clones out into a clonal screening trial.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Tim Guylander, forester with Weyerhaeuser in Drayton Valley. He's in charge of the Aspen Tree Improvement Program. Coming up, a look at poplar farming from the landowner's perspective. This week, the Woodlot Association of Alberta launched its new magazine, The Western Woodlot Conservationist. The feature report is all about poplar power, and it profiles the various aspects of growing hybrid poplars on private land. Dan McPherson is a forester. He has a woodlot near Newbrook. He works as a forest management consultant with the Alberta Treasury Branch, and he's the president of the Woodlot Association of Alberta.
Growing hybrid poplars really should be looked at as an agricultural alternative crop. There's a lot of opportunity in northern Alberta with the existence of several very active pulp mills which have hybrid poplar programs to grow them on either lease or a freehand for the pulp companies. And I think that the economics involved with it are very attractive to the landowners, especially if they're looking close and getting close to the retirement years.
What would be some of the environmental impacts or benefits of growing hybrid poplars on land, on what had been farmland?
Well, there's the potential for increasing the drainage. Poplars have been found in Europe where they've been removed from their sites and conifers have been grown that without the root systems that the hybrid poplars, the deep rooting pattern that the hybrid poplars have, the drainage patterns are disrupted and sometimes you get flooding in it. And what happens with the poplars is where the roots have gone down deep into the soil and have died, they've provided drainage channels. Also, another benefit is they are a little higher in salt tolerance than some of the other species. And where you may have had a salt arise and rise up to the surface in agricultural soils because of the surface drying, the poplars really help to pull the salt horizon down lower in the soil.
Is this something that would help extend the green area, maybe encourage more wildlife?
Well, there's definitely a lot more wildlife in hybrid poplar plantations, even though they are a fairly sterile forest as far as forest biodiversity is concerned. You still get a lot more wildlife in them than you would, say, in an open hay field.
If the hybrid poplars take 20 or 25 years to grow, that's an awfully long crop cycle to go through if someone is used to planting a crop and harvesting it and selling it on a yearly basis. How do you compensate for the time factor?
Well, if a person's in his 40s or 50s, you have to look ahead 15 to 20 years to when you're looking to retire. And what I'd probably recommend is that you don't plant your entire land holdings in 1 year, but probably in 20-acre parcels on a yearly basis to the point where you get it all planted up and maybe over a 15 to 20-year period. And then you can enjoy for the next 15 or 20 years in your retirement. You can enjoy the opportunity to sit back and harvest the crop that you've grown. And also during that 15 to 20-year period when you're planting up your land, you probably extend the life of your machinery and help avoid additional capital expenses just before you're retiring. So if you have good planning, I think it'll work really well.
For someone who might be interested in taking this up, how would you get involved? Where would you start?
Well, there's a number of forest companies that are very interested in getting involved with landowners and hybrid poppers, and there's a number of different options, and I would strongly suggest that you talk to them directly. And the Woodlot Association of Alberta can provide you with some contact names if you're interested in that respect. In addition, if you want other information on hybrid poppers, there are a number of people around that can give you some information. The Woodlot Association of Alberta's first issue of the Western Woodlot Conservationist highlighted the popper programs in Alberta that are connected with the industry.
It seems to me that this is an endeavor where you're looking ahead, it's very long term, and it also involves an awful lot of land stewardship issues. Is that the way you see it?
Yes, it's very important to have a long-term vision, and this fits really well in the rural agricultural communities because there's been a lot of history in Alberta, at least 100 years, where the family farm has been very central to the communities. And what's really great about woodlot stewardship is that it fits really well in a family context and over the long term, because really what you're doing is you're building for the future if you're managing native forest lands. That's very much different from the hybrid poplar, which is only on a 20-year term. The native forest stand management, some of it's up to a 50 or 60-year a period of management that you're looking at, and it can sustain some incredibly good economic returns, especially for somebody who has invested time and money into it. And I think it's really important that it has to rest in this context, because I plan on passing my woodlot off to my children and hopefully have encouraged enough interest in it for them to stay involved, and hopefully my grandchildren will be interested in it. So I think it really fits well in rural Alberta.
Thank you very much, Dan.
You're welcome, and thank you, Cheryl.
Dan McPherson is president of the Woodlot Association of Alberta. Check out their website at woodlot.org and look for their new magazine, The Western Woodlot Conservationist. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. You can listen to previous programs on Real Audio or download them from the web. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.